You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your co-host, Ankit Panda, here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm your co-host, Katie Putz, also in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Katie. Good to be back. How's it going?
Going all right. Spring is coming in D.C.
It is, yeah, although it's a little rainy today, unfortunately, but it is nice that things are starting to warm up. But it is again that time of year in Washington with budgets and hearings, and we've actually had the rollout of just the recent annual threat assessment from the U.S. Director of National Intelligence. So I think that's a perfect opportunity to talk a bit about how the United States today perceives, at least analytically in terms of the intelligence community's assessments, many of the threats in Asia specifically. And so no surprise on this episode, we'll talk about China and North Korea, but also a few other things. But Katie, you just wrote about this for The Diplomat, so I wanted to turn it over to you to kind of maybe kick us off with your observations on the top line findings from the IC on China specifically, I think. I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah, certainly. So the annual threat assessment is essentially a public summary of a briefing that's given to members of Congress on what the intelligence community in the United States views as the threats facing the United States in the next year. And to be fair, it's a pretty predictable list usually. You have China, you have Russia, you have Iran. What I thought was interesting was the way this report this year was divided was into state actors and transnational issues, but sort of woven throughout the entire document is China. China kind of pops up in every single one of these categories in one way or another. I think in particular, what's interesting to me and something that I definitely want to get your thoughts on is the distinctions that are made between the kind of threat, quote unquote, threat that China poses to the United States versus the kind of threat North Korea and Russia and Iran kind of present. China is sort of laid out in this document as ambitious but anxious, whereas Russia is confrontational. China, in one section, it says, you know, China's serious demographic and economic challenges may make it an even more aggressive and unpredictable global actor. And the next sentence is, Russia's ongoing aggression in Ukraine underscores that it remains a threat to the rules-based international order. So to me, that sort of comes across as a little bit of a hedging that China is this big risk and this big threat to the United States, but there's room to deal with it in a way that there doesn't seem to be that kind of space with Russia. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that. And there's certainly a lot more. I did write about this, but there's a lot more than what I could cover in that article. So that's why I really wanted to talk through it today. So what do you have to think about that sort of distinction there?
Yeah, so I think two observations I would make there, right? On the one hand, about this idea of anxiety and ambition in China, I think that's the articulation of something that's really been bubbling analytically, certainly in the public debate here in Washington and around the U.S. about China, but probably also within the intelligence community, which is what is more dangerous for the United States and Asia? Is it a confidently rising China that all indicators suggest is simply going to become more powerful year on year, economically, demographically, militarily? Or by contrast, is it more dangerous to have a world where China, either through self-perception or objectively, has peaked and is now suffering headwinds demographically, economically, so on and so forth? And I think what's interesting in the annual threat assessment language is that I would argue a lot of the indicators we see from China today suggest that we are practically more likely to be dealing with that latter China, right? I think the Chinese economy is not doing very well. The demographic headwinds, of course, have been long understood in China. And so does this create something of a set of incentives in Beijing that China, if its power is to peak, perhaps in the coming years, perhaps by 2030, or perhaps in the early 2030s, that will be the moment when China should resort to some of the more dramatic steps that it might, such as choosing to unify with Taiwan using military force or pursuing other revisionist objectives. So I think that's really what I see as kind of bubbling up. And then on Russia and China, you know, one of the frustrations that I often have here in DC is that it is very common to go to any number of conversations and meetings about geopolitical issues or military issues, and inevitably there will be multiple people in the room that very uncritically use that phrase, Russia and China, Russia and China, Russia and China, be it about nuclear weapons, interstate war, about hybrid warfare, Russia and China are lumped together as the two big bad guys that the United States needs to be concerned about. But I think what the annual threat assessment fundamentally gets right, and I wouldn't expect anything less, frankly, is to ultimately realize that these are two very different countries with very different capabilities, intentions, strategic outlooks, even leaderships, right? It is, of course, very easy to paint with that broad brush that these are authoritarian adversaries of the United States that seek to interfere within U.S. borders and seek to make the world more difficult for the United States to execute its visions, so on and so forth, and that's true. But the means, ways, and capabilities, fundamentally, I think, vary quite a bit. And I think that's really what the threat assessment gets right. But I mean, this also kind of bubbled up in the Biden administration's national defense strategy and national security strategy. This idea of Russia being, well, I mean, those documents, of course, were delayed by the onset of the Ukraine war, particularly the NDS. But this idea that Russia is going to be a short-term confrontational actor that's going to really make things quite difficult for the United States, but that China is the longer term systemic threat potentially to the ability of the United States to continue shaping world affairs in the way that it has. So I think that's how I kind of interpret that. But I think that's a really useful thing to flag, because I think in order to have sensible geopolitical conversations here in Washington, you have to be able to disaggregate Russia and China as two different countries that, while they get along, they don't see eye to eye on everything.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation, especially because, you know, even if there are similarities, not everything is exactly the same. And it's in those differences, which is where policy should address. Another thing that I thought was interesting in the annual threat assessment was, you know, there was a section on conflicts and fragility. It sort of fell under the state actor section. And there was obviously a section on Gaza and the conflict in the Middle East. But what I found particularly interesting was that in the category of potential interstate conflicts, so conflicts between states, almost all of them are in Asia, whereas the potential intrastate turmoil section, so, you know, unrest within countries that could cause risk to the United States, those are almost exclusively not in Asia, with the exception of Afghanistan has its own little special section. But, you know, under this sort of potential interstate conflict, there's China maritime is one area, you know, and highlights issues the Philippines has had in the South China Sea, tensions between China and Japan over the Senkakus and those kind of things. India-China, India-Pakistan, and then Azerbaijan-Armenia, which is a little bit outside of our coverage area. But all of these sort of interstate conflicts that the intelligence community is saying are potential threats or sources of risks for the United States, those are all in Asia. And a lot of them have to do with either India or China. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting mapping. Are there any that you think that got left out? Because obviously in a report of this size, which it's not a very long report, it's 40 some pages, there's ostensibly stuff that gets left on the cutting room floor. So I'm curious if you have thoughts on what maybe was left out of either this section or the report writ large.
Well, I mean, the big obvious one is the Korean Peninsula. But I guess given the fact that the U.S. actually considers the Korean Peninsula to be entirely the territory of the Republic of Korea, maybe it didn't make sense to put it under the interstate conflict. But Kim Jong-un...
And North Korea gets its own section, so...
Exactly. They get their own section. But that's really the only other one. I mean, just on these crises, though, I think... on these potential interstate conflicts, I think what's notable is that almost in all cases, the suggestion is that... there is a great potential for a crisis that can spiral out of control, right? It's this idea that things are calm until they aren't. And I think that's especially true in the India-China, India-Pakistan cases, where it is tempting to look at the strategic predicament on the disputed border between in sort of both those dyads, India-China and India-Pakistan, and conclude that escalation into armed conflict is not very likely in the short term. But I think recent history, 2020, 2019, suggests that very quickly, you can have a set of events spiral to a point where the potential for a clash is, again, quite real. So I think, I think the goal of something like the annual threat assessment is to put certain issues on the agenda that have a tendency of falling off. And I think that's very useful here with sort of talking about some of these potential crises that don't get talked about enough until they actually break out. And then everybody's like, oh yeah, India and Pakistan, that's still a thing. I think the threat assessment does a good job there. I think what's interesting about India-China, though, is that the potential for cross-border clashes turning into risking miscalculation and escalation into armed conflict, I think it's interesting that it's sort of unsaid, I mean, how significant that armed conflict really could be, right? Because I think that's been one of the limiting factors in the India-China case, which is even after 2020, basically plunged relations between the two countries to the worst point they have been in more than 40 years. The potential for like a serious armed military clash, you know, involving sort of missiles, tanks, or long-range fires or anything like that appeared to still be quite limited, just given that India and China still have certain rules of the road. So I find that sort of suggestion to be somewhat interesting. And also, you know, they do note here that the two sides have not engaged in significant cross-border clashes since 2020.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's definitely worth noting, and particularly that these are things that sometimes do fall off the radar, but have great potential to be very bad if they kind of pop off, to use the technical term. And then I think we should sort of close this out with the discussion of some of the transnational issues. One of the things that you sort of touched on, you used the word sort of spiraling. The report uses the phrase cascading a lot, not a lot, but occasionally, in the sense that, you know, some kind of threat or problem in one area can kind of cascade into larger issues elsewhere, which is not, you know, the most novel of conclusions, but I think is an important one. And I think you see this a lot in the second half, which covers sort of transnational issues, which is a huge variety of things, kind of everything from disruptive technology to climate change. There's mention of white supremacist violence, though interestingly, and this is maybe a little peeve that I have with this report, is that, you know, when the United States intelligence community thinks about threats, it looks externally, and this report is very external oriented. It doesn't even list the United States when it talks about white supremacist violence. It lists basically everywhere else in the world, including Canada, but not the United States. And I think that that's a little bit of an oversight. And in a place that I highlighted in the article that I wrote, referenced, this actually was earlier in the report, but referenced malign actors and sort of malign influence operations. And it used the language that, you know, it was talking about China. It said Beijing's growing efforts to actively exploit perceived U.S. societal divisions using online personas. To me, I don't know that there's so much as perceived as actual societal divisions that are being exploited. And so if you're going to actually get to the heart of the threat, you have to deal with the actual societal divisions. It's not just a perception, but maybe that's just me wanting too much from this report. Yeah. But that is something I wanted to point out, because I think at the heart of some of these issues, there, for example, one of the transnational threats included is migration. Migration is a huge third rail issue in the United States domestically, immigration. And so, you know, the potential for immigration to be an external threat, sure, but part of that has to do with U.S. domestic policy and sort of the interwoven nature of these things.
Yeah. I wonder if that's just a function of the way the statutory requirement is sort of listed in the Intelligence Authorization Act, because with the exception of the FBI, the rest of, I mean, the CIA, for instance, can't statutorily, I guess, operate in the U.S.
Oh, definitely.
So maybe that's just why the ATA focuses on the external. But yeah, I mean, some of that, I think, is quite glaring.
I think that is definitely true. But certainly us on the outside using this report, it is not a sort of, and even it says in the report, it's not an exhaustive list of the threats the United States faces. Mm-hmm. So I think this needs to be looked at in conjunction with other measures of risk and threat. But it certainly is useful as a guideline.
I mean, I will say, though, like, I think it is good to see that as units of analysis and sort of thinking about threats, it no longer makes sense to just talk about really, I mean, just state and non-state actors, as in the old days, right? Violent extremist organizations and state actors, which used to be the traditional approach to talking about these things in the U.S. A lot of this is now transnational. I mean, even the far-right politics and white supremacist politics have a very transnational nature to them, right? And so I think the framing of these issues in that way, I think, just makes a lot of sense, given just how complex these issues have grown and the fundamental linkages across borders in many cases.
Yeah, I certainly think the second half of the report sort of really dives into this emerging complexity and the recognition of that. And I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. All right, Katie. So I think we'll leave it there today.
All right. This has been fun.
Sounds good. We'll be back soon. For listeners, if you like what you heard on the podcast, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, please don't forget to leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts, and we really do appreciate that. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.